the Wildlife Observer Network.
All right, welcome to Wildlife Observer Network on the Wing Travelcast. I'm here. I'm Tony Crozdell here with
Alvaro Jaramillo,
and it is a pleasure. I usually have guests introduce themselves so I get their proper pronunciation of the name. Because I went to Brazil, I spent a fair amount of time in Brazil, took Portuguese. I always forget to pronounce J's as H's. right. And, when I see something in a Latin alphabet, so I'm happy to not have made that mistake on the air. Although I just said I would have done it anyway, so it's like the same thing.
Well, you're lucky. Tony works in so many languages, you know.
Yeah. Well, then when I was in Brazil, they kept calling me Joni.
Oh yeah, yeah, Joni. Yeah, yeah.
Like Joni, and I'm like,
yeah, you're like. Yeah. Joni Mitchell.
Which is funny because like the name Tony is usually associated with like city tough guys, like yo Tony. And then in Brazil they're like Joni? So yeah. So you are my friend. We don't hang out nearly as much as we'd like to. I know you through George Armistead, who I do a podcast with on this network. And we went to see Stiff Little Fingers together because we both share background. We could actually make this like a COA episode of the Burning Punks with Paul Riss, because we mentioned you too in that our first episode. But it is you are a man of many hats. You are an author. I hold one of your books in my hand right here, and literally, which is The Birds of Chile. I also just ordered the New World Blackbirds that you wrote that came out in 1999. That surprisingly, I didn't have it. You can see I own I pride myself on owning a good amount of bird books. I didn't actually have it, so I just ordered it. Although none of that money would go to you because it's used, but I'll buy you a beer next time.
All right. See.
You also run
a
your
new
own
beer. I don't want to use beer.
Yes, yes. You also have a tour company.
Yeah, yeah, it's called Alvaro's Adventures. So based here in California, Central California, Half Moon Bay.
So it's hard to know where to begin with you. In fact, we just, before we started, we talked for 20 minutes about renaming birds. And we're going to get into that on a separate podcast and blog series of blog posts. Although what was interesting was that you... you actually are on some committees at Name Birds, and you are a person who likes unique and names that aren't standardized.
Yeah.
So that's.
I just like memorable names, you know?
Yeah.
Things, you know, like that, especially the person who's using it just will remember the name and therefore might remember the bird, like killdeer. People don't forget the name killdeer, but you know, least sandpiper, a lot of people just go, oh, it's sandpiper, something or other. Yeah. Actually, especially beginner birders remember the word peep, like they know it's a peep for some reason because that appeals to them, that word, the sound. And same thing killdeer, I think, you know, like it's just memorable. Yeah, I like those names.
The thing is, you get to a critical mass, though, when it can be too confusing, right? Too hard to remember, because I have difficulty remembering Hawaiian birds and English-named European birds, because so many of them have, like chaffinch and dunnock and all those, they're not, like, you know, they're not, like, so, well, chaffinch is an old bird warbler, right? Am I mistaken?
No, chaffinch. Yeah, it's like a fringillid finch, so that means, it's more closely related to a goldfinch, yeah.
Right. What's the one of them is I'm trying to remember. I get so confused as what's what over there. And it's hard for me to remember. So it's interesting. You know, you think makes it more memorable to me. I think it can kind of hear where there's mostly standardized and then a few aberrant ones.
Yeah. In Spanish, well, not in Spanish, but in certain countries that speak Spanish, names are sometimes don't have that sort of last name to a bird. Like, so here we have like Cape May warbler Blackpool, you know, or whatever war, you know. And then people get confused when you have like the common yellow throat and you tell them it's a warbler, and they'll say, oh, but why didn't they just call it, you know, something warbler? A lot of the names in Chile and, you know, Argentina don't have that second name, that last name. So they just have a single word name, and you have no idea that a certain thing is a woodpecker versus, you know, a grebe or whatever. And it's funny because I think that's what you're getting at. If you don't have that, in a sense, it's a name that's putting it into some kind of taxonomic context, it becomes more confusing. But in another realm of names, people just sort of don't care about the taxonomic. They just know, oh, that one is this one, and that one is that one. They don't, they're not trying to put it into this sort of world perspective order. So I think that's where you get, you know, like killdeer. It makes no sense, right? It doesn't, it's not killdeer plover. If it was, I think it would be less useful in some ways. I wouldn't like the name as much as killdeer, but others would say, oh yeah, you know, that now we know it's a plover, right? We get information. It's sort of an interesting way how we might actually, it might be our culture that does that, that puts it into this structure, and we need the names to work as a structure. I don't know.
To get into, well, you know, we're going to go back. We'll have that discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
When we get to the little preview. This podcast is about, episode is about you. How did you, you're involved in birding and ornithology in many ways. And I'd like to know, so let's hit some bullet points real quick and let's try to fill them in. Right. So I know you were you lived a lot of your life in Toronto. Where were you born?
I was born in Chile and I grew up in Toronto. So I moved there when I was a kid. So, you know, little kid.
So Chile, Toronto.
Schooling. Yeah. Was in Toronto school, all that.
So here's the bullet points. Right? Born in Chile, then Toronto. Somehow you made your way out to California. And along the way, you wrote three books, started your own tour company, and you served on a bunch of committees. So let's walk us through, if you can, how you got to.
So here's the thing. If you had to really sort of boil it down to this, sort of the essence of it is, as a kid, I became a birder, like maybe at 11 years old. Very quickly thought, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, right? And then followed through, went to school and all that. But along the way, sort of real life happens. All sorts of things that you thought were going to be A become B, you know? And then, but I just always had a single-minded, I will be a person working with birds. And I didn't necessarily, that work with birds broadened as I got older. It was much more narrow when I was young. I was like, I thought I'd be like a university professor or something. And then it broadened and I just made it happen whatever way I could with a lot of ups and downs, right? So you're just talking about the ups. Oh, the books, you know, there's the other points where you're like, oh crap, you know, I don't like this project I'm doing, you know, and I can't see myself doing a PhD for 2 or 3 years or whatever. And I don't like this. I'm not enjoying it. And, you know, just deciding, okay, I'm gonna drop out of my PhD program. And all my friends saying, oh no, man, this is, you know, this is where things happen. This is where you become what you want to become. And then I realized, well, I actually don't know what I will be, but I just know I'll work with birds. So that was my single guiding kind of thing. And I found my way through various different things I could do, right? I mean, I didn't think I could write. Then I find myself writing a book. Then I didn't know, you know, I could learn all these birds in other countries. And I just went out there and went birding and learned birds in other countries and started putting things together, organizing them, put together tours, books and stuff. So yeah, I think it's an unconventional way to have become a bird person. Because, you know, I'm maybe more today, these things are more open to more people. Like actually becoming a tour guide is something that, you know, is there. But when I was sort of growing up, you know, it's like you heard about Ted Parker and these people who are like doing things in Peru. You didn't know you could do that.
But he did it without a degree, without an advanced degree, right?
Right.
So
yeah, and I mean, I think a lot of the early people, like the Ted Parkers, the Ken Kaufmans, you know, who are sort of a generation older than I am, you know, they were sort of that hippie kind of deal, you know, and they could just do that. And I guess I came out more of like the punk rock, do it yourself, figure it out. But, you know, I don't know how it all happened, but there was an idea that I sort of had to work with my passion, that I would fail at anything else I did, you know. So, you know, because I did well in school. I could have been some other thing, right?
Like, yeah.
You know, accountant. Insurance guy. I don't know.
So how did you first start doing birds as a profession? So when did you start? How old were you to start birding?
About 11, I think 11 years old. Yeah. I did quickly, like when I was a teenager, start getting involved with people and projects. Like there was a junior field naturalist group and they had like a newsletter, annual newsletter. So I, you know, wrote a little article, did some drawings or something as a kid. And you start getting those elements of like, oh, you know, people don't mind if, or, you know, they're happy for you to do something. So I got more involved in doing things. There were like annual summaries of birds later on that, you know, that sort of the adults were putting together, like the year, you know, what happened, all the rare birds. And I was, you know, I would collate them and help out with all that stuff. So I think as a kid, essentially, when you get working with adults and they think that the work you're doing is fine, it gives you the confidence to say, oh, if I can do A, I can do B. And you just sort of stone up into eventually, you know, you don't know how the heck you wound up writing a book because it seems so odd, but you realize that all those little things along the way were what made you have the, you know, I it's not even confidence. It's sometimes just like lunacy, you know, do something, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, how did you work the book on the New World Blackbirds? Like, how did that happen? Like, why blackbirds? Like, walk us through that project.
So, when I went to school in Toronto, University of Toronto, out of all the people I met there, one who was a key figure was Professor Jim Rising, who he worked with sparrows, and he was a birder, and he was an ornithologist, and he was one of the people who worked with the Bullock's Baltimore Oriole hybrid zone, and he'd done all of this interesting stuff that was, you know, I started sort of getting a little bit involved in. And there was a point in time I worked at a bookstore on the weekends, and I, you know, to make some money to pay for school. That was a nature and travel bookstore, and I started reading about this guy, William Henry Hudson in Argentina. Well, hey, not reading about him. Actually, I was reading his books, and he describes all these cool natural history phenoms that were happening, and the Rias doing this and that. And there's this point where he describes this blackbird that's like a cowbird, and it parasitizes another kind of blackbird, which was at the time thought to be another kind of cowbird, but it nested properly like a regular bird. That it imitated all of the aspects of the host, that it was like mimicking the host in many ways. And I thought, that's really cool. That's wild. And at that point, I was thinking, what am I going to do for my master's? I want to do a master's. And I went to Jim, and Jim was sort of like, if he thought you were passionate about something, you go, yeah. He wasn't one of those professors that would say, well, you know, like, this is going to be tough, man. So I said, can I go work on this in Argentina? And he's like, sure, you know. So I did. And I spent a couple of years working on these mimicry and this weird situation that happens with this screaming cowbird that parasitizes its bird called the baywing. It used to be called the Baywing Cowbird. We got rid of the cowbird part because it really isn't a cowbird. But it was so crazy. It was so amazing to see like a bird that looks exactly like the other bird, and you have them in your hand, like the chicks, and you can't tell them apart except by looking at the shape of their nasal cavity, you know, like they're so the same. And then when that screaming cowbird leaves the nest, it actually molts his entire body and becomes a completely different looking thing. It's like the sheep and, you know, the wolf in sheep's clothing, you know, kind of thing. And I got just amazed by blackbirds. And then I realized that one of the first birds I'd ever seen was a red-winged blackbird. And I thought it was so interesting. And then you start reading about the science and, you know, they're males and they have multiple females, yet the females are actually mating with all these other males. And so any one nest, you know, it's not sired by the one male, but by multiple males. And then you see, you know, grackles and the way that, you know, the size differences, neural pendulas. And I was thinking, you know what, these are actually the most interesting birds on Earth practically. And nobody cares. You know, it's like they're parasites. They have all of these things going on. Like I always tell people that if it wasn't for the color of warblers, they're kind of boring. Mm. They just, you know, even their songs are kind of like not that great. You know what I mean? Yet, you know, you go watch a colony of tricolored blackbirds or something, you're not going to be bored. There's so much going on. You know, this is going, they're bringing in food. They're doing this. The epaulets are going out. The noise is happening. Everything is crazy, you know? I mean, even them, tricolor blackbirds are the only colonial land bird we have left after the passenger pigeon. You know, it's like they're synchronized colonies of these things that used to be hundreds of thousands strong. And that colonial aspect is one of the reasons they might be becoming rare. So you see, I could go on about blackbirds. I just found them so exciting.
Yeah.
I was like, I want to find out more. So I thought I'd start putting together, you know, orioles, all those birds, you know, sort of, that's how it happened, I guess, you know, just sort of out of, again, I get kind of a passion for them.
And how'd you get hooked up with that series? Cause I have a few of those, like when we started talking before, I was like, do I have that book? Just cause every one of those series I could find, I purchase, you know, in person generally, if the price is reasonable.
Well, I mean, I think Seabirds, the first one that came out by Peter Harrison, and then eventually Shorebirds, were two of the most influential books back in the day that kind of came out. And I was just so, I was thinking, like, if I'm going to do this, I want it to be part of that series because those are cool books.
Yeah.
And then later there was one that's not well known. It was like Chickadees, Titmice, Nuthatches.
Yeah.
But it was super well done, like with all of this detail. And I used that as a model of, like, you know, just trying to get anything I could find out and just stick it in the book. So, yeah, it was a real element of, like, needed artwork. So I had to work with my good friend Peter Burke. We figured out, you know, how to paint from, you know, specimens and descriptions and what things were available, who to talk to, and how you get specimens like shipped to the local museums. And then, you know, it was a time before digital photography, so we didn't have nearly as much material. That book would be way better now. Yeah, but anyway. But I think it's like a lot of things we do in life. You're sort of trying to see if you can do it, you know, and put something down that is going to last. And also that gives you confidence to do other things.
Now, you said that you were doing them before we were talking. You said you stopped doing a PhD program. Did you finish your master's on the
Blackboard? Yeah, I finished the master's, but the PhD, I never did. The book is the PhD. I started doing the Blackbirds book while I was in school. And, you know, I remember all the other students going like, dude, you can't be writing a book and doing a PhD. That's stupid. You know, one of them is going to have to give. It's like, okay, well, I guess the book is done.
Yeah. Well, how many people have the dissertations on thousands of other shelves?
You know? Right.
So, maybe you made the right, I think you probably made the right choice. How many, you know, this question never asked of anybody who wrote a book is, how many? Is that a question I can ask you? How many of those books exist?
I could look it up, but It's not as many as you would think for like one of those, because, you know, they were big hardcover, but the Birds of Chile, in there, there's something like 25,000 plus, like the Spanish edition also is multiple thousands. And in fact, the Spanish edition has been amazingly well received. And some people have told me that it really sort of made birding become a thing in Chile. So I'm like pretty proud of that. We were diligent about, like, once the English version was published, we would figure out a way to get it published in Spanish. And we did within a year. So,
oh, that's fantastic. Vital. And that's Princeton. I love Princeton. I'm a fanboy. I always joke, you know, the famous picture of Al Pacino and Scarface where he just got mounds of cocaine on the desk.
Yeah.
I'm gonna recreate that photo with this mounds of Princeton field guides. Yeah. It's probably of the two bookshelves behind me, you know, that are probably
that's right.
A fifth of them at least are Princeton guides, maybe a right. third, I don't know. So just mounds of Princeton field guides just because I love them. And, you know, whenever I go to a convention and they're, you know, or an expo or whatever, and there's their booth, I woke up and I'm like, got it, need it. So did you approach them? Or they approach you? And bring us to your, I mean, you were born there. How did you get writing the field guide there?
So the way it worked with the book, I didn't know about various aspects of how these book things work, right? But the series that I did the Blackbirds with was called Helm. And the Helm group then was sold and this and that, whatever. But when I started the Birds of Chile book, they sort of said, we'll do it. And we'll at the same time co-publish with Princeton. So it was like a co-published thing. So if you buy it in England, it has a different cover and it has a whole different look to the outside. And it, you know, I think it still says Helm series or whatever. And then Princeton was the group that took it on, you know, locally and in US. And then we had Lynx, which is, you know, the Birds of the World series. They actually did the Spanish version. But one of the great things about Princeton is the editor, Robert Kirk, is a fantastic person, great birder, just great person to work with. So that helps a lot when you have people who, you know, really like the subject. You know, he actually, you know, and he used to be a rock and roll roadie. There's another guy who you might want to have.
it's been, George and I have been discussing, we're going to make it happen. Yeah. What was it? Deep Purple?
Yeah.
We're gonna get make that happen. And yeah, so were you, I assume you guided. What year did this come out?
Oh, I don't remember.
So
yeah, it's like 2003 or something like that.
2003, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're born there. You wrote the book, so you must have been there a bunch of times and be familiar with the birds, right? How that were you leaning there before the guide? Yeah. When you start?
Yes, you know. What happened was that, like, if when I went to high school at that time, you know, in Canada, you had like this preliminary high school year before university. It was like the 13th grade, like it was an additional year, but you could take all your credits as you wanted. So I actually took them all in the half of the year, so I could have a full free half year. So when I finished high school, I just decided I had a bunch of money saved up and I went to Chile. That was the first time I'd been back since I was a kid. So I went to see family, you know, so to see my grandma and all my aunts, cousins, and so forth, but also to go birding. So it, you know, there's a bunch of stories in that whole thing. Like I was, you know, I got a cheap ticket and it stopped in Paraguay. So actually the first place I birded outside of the U.S. and Canada was Paraguay, which is the weirdest place to go, you know, like yeah. nobody goes to Paraguay. But anyways, I wound up in Chile and I started birding and visiting relatives and taking the bus or hitchhiking or doing this and that and sort of slowly trying to put things together. And there were no real field guides. So it was really tough. And I would take a lot of notes and actually eventually would visit museums. I would get in on visiting museums and look at all the specimens and all that. And little by little, I just started getting, without knowing it, this idea that I should put all this together so that nobody has to suffer through this stupidity of not knowing what anything is. And just at that point, when I first started doing that, I hadn't done any books yet, right? So that was in high school. So I hadn't done the Blackbird's book, but I was already good friends with Peter Berg. I mean, Peter's been kind of a constant in my sort of birding life since we met as teenagers, and we've been kind of friends forever. And he's an amazing artist. So,
yeah,
you know, eventually,
I love the illustrations in this guide. They're top notch.
Yeah, he's good, you know, and we eventually, you know, then from that, I got to know the birds. Then I started tour leading. First, there's this a tour company called Eagle Eyes, and I was the first guide ever in Eagle Eyes. So it started with somebody who didn't quite know how all this tour stuff worked. And I started putting together tours for him, and he built up a company, eventually sold it. So one of the first, maybe the third or fourth trip I ever did with them was to go to Chile. And the first bunch of trips, it was me with Peter. We would co-guide. And so we both got to know the birds and got to know the country tip to tip. And eventually, you know, we just thought, okay, we can do this. You know, we can start putting it together. And we have Dave Beatles, another artist who's involved in that book. We got Dave, you know, who lives in Toronto as well. So it was sort of this group of people all knew each other, and we started working on it. But it was mainly kind of backpacking trips and visiting family to first learn the birds enough that I could lead a trip. And then once I led a trip, I got to lead a few more. And, you know, by the time that, you know, I really was sort of, you know, knew what I was doing, I'd already had most of the book put together. So, yeah. And, yeah.
Now, how much has taxonomy changed since this book came out? Will you have to do a new one anytime soon, or what's the?
Yeah, we're hoping to be able to do a new one eventually. You know, there's a bunch of stuff that has to happen, new plates here and there, and new taxonomy, revise sort of the order of some things, maybe get some of the plates that we don't like as much as others redone. That's the plan. I mean, it's actually now relatively old for a field guide, right? And I mean, I've been to parties, you know, barbecues and people drinking beer in Chile were all a bunch of birders. Where eventually, you know, somebody says, you know, that this map here is not right or whatever. And it's funny because I think that a lot of people get offended if somebody points out something that's incorrect. And what I point out is that at the time that was right. And what we've learned in the meantime, what that person has to offer saying that, no, the distribution's different now. It's not that it's different now. It probably always was that. We just didn't know.
Yeah.
And now, you know, 'cause there's all these other people doing the work. So in a sense, like having the book become outdated because the information's not as valid anymore is part of the goal of the book.
How does someone put together the range maps?
So there's like the specimens that are out there, you know, that you can plot, and then observations that you know are good or you've made or valid or what have you. And then there's an element of like, well, these seem to be fitting some kind of, you know, type of habitat. So like if you know, like I think you could go through the mental exercise. If you took hooded warbler where you live and to the south, and you sort of put together the habitat type, you would predict it should also be in southernmost Ontario, but not further up, like not into Algonquin Park. That habitat is already too different.
Yeah.
It's like that southernmost part of it, and you'd be right in your prediction, right? Yeah, you could actually, you can predict a certain amount of distribution by knowing what a bird likes, even if you don't have the data. So there was times that we would guess, but it's an educated guess, right? Based on what we knew should occur, but you know, and most of the time we got it right. We were conservative too, you know. We weren't going crazy, you know, like
yeah.
Penguins up in the mountains or something.
It's funny how things like that change. Like I remember I went to Newfoundland and with Matt Halley. You know Matt?
I don't know if we've met. No.
He's a Guinness PhD at the Academy of Natural Sciences, Drexel, and he studies thrushes. He's one of my best friends. So he was going up there to do assist on a project with gray cheek thrush. And so I just did a drive with him and flew back. And I was excited when I was up there because I'd never seen red-throated loon in breeding plumage. I since have, actually, in New Jersey, actually. But it just never, you know, I've been up to Alaska, I've been up to Manitoba for some reason, and never, I never actually seen them in their breeding plumage. And I just really wanted to see it. And I was like, well, in the Sibley Guide, Newfoundland's all colored in orange, so I'm going to see one. And didn't see one the whole time I was there. I was like, that's... And then, like, I started looking up eBird. I started looking up... And then when the new Sibley Guide came out, Newfoundland's blank.
Oh, right.
I'm like, where did... I guess maybe it was one of those things. You're like, maybe it's... The habitat looks right for it. Maybe it should be there. But
yeah. And you know, obviously, when you do that kind of thing, you have people look through, right? So, you know, and fix any errors that come up, but there's an element of it that obviously North America, we have a lot more info, you know, so it's harder to get to that point where you're like really getting something completely off. But, you know, the whole idea of maps is relatively new if you think about it. Like, I mean, the original Petersons didn't have maps, you know. It was like Golden Guide started with maps, and then some of the South American field guides, all the original ones, like Birds of, you know, Venezuela, Birds of Colombia, Birds of Venezuela, you know, the old ones, Birds of Panama, they didn't have any maps. And you think how that is so crazy now in today's world to think. Or even that some of these guides used to have like a bunch of colorful, what was crazy is like they'd have like a set of color plates with all the most colorful birds, right? Like the tanagers or whatever. And then they'd have, like, if you look at old Birds of Venezuela, a lot of the flycatchers were all in black and white. And you're like, what's the point of that? Like, I mean, the person, you know, guide tutor or whatever, probably, actually didn't paint those in black and white. They're actually a color version exists, but they're trying to save money and this and that. And you think printing was more costly when those people were working in the 80s or whatever, but it seems so crazy now that anybody would spend like decades of work to try to do something and not put maps and not put everything full color.
Yeah.
So we're now in an embarrassment of riches. It's so easy to actually put together a map. You could draw up a map from eBird today. You know, it's great. Like anybody who, you know, any sort of old school birder who says, you know, things are really bad now, you know, and the birding has changed and things, they're not really looking at what it used to be like. You know, it's sort of like, you know, you have to phone somebody to find out if there was a good bird around, and if they hadn't received the call, you wouldn't know. You know, now it just pops up in your, you know, on your cell. It's like, hey, rare bird, a map. You can get a song right away. It's crazy how amazing it is to be a birder right now. Like anybody who's into birding now should be so happy.
It's crazy. People, I mean, I've been birding, you know, I'm not that much younger than you. And I did, you know, how old are you, by the way?
52.
Yeah. Especially. So, you're really like 9 years older than me. So I got into birding before eBird, and I see birding memes now where people make comments about like not doing complete checklist, or not including photos. And I'm like,
yeah,
I'm sorry. Like, when I go birding, I want to watch birds. Like, I don't want to have to like document everything and bring this extra piece of equipment with me, right, and spend thousands of dollars on it to get, you know, because otherwise we're not going to, you know, if it's just a point and shoot. And it's weird how like people who grew, people forget that eBird turned a hobby into data. Mm-hmm. And now people think that it's like you have to, not only do you have to eBird if you're birding, but you have to document everything you, you know, like, and it has to have photos. And I'm like, well, that's not how it used to be. It used to be just be like you were birding and you took a list, but like now it's like, it's this expectation, which is fine. And, you know, I get that, but it's strange how people don't realize what it was like when you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, it's kind of a wonderful time. And, you know, to watch also the Chilean birding scene now, those first times when I went there and I was, you know, a teenager, there were basically no birders. And there were a few university type ornithologists and a couple of sort of people who were, you know, into birds. But now, you know, there's lots, you know, lots, and they're actually doing amazing stuff, finding all sorts of, you know, they found where all the storm petrels breed in the middle of the desert, you know, some really neat things that are going on from people who are basically birders. Like, their jobs are architects and, you know, they do other things, and this is like their passion, but they're actually changing the, you know, history of ornithology and it's amazing to see that, you know. Or you can go to Colombia or Brazil now, there's a lot of birders. They didn't used to be, they were like none.
Yeah,
you know, so
it's amazing time. Yeah. So you started guiding for another company. How do you start your own company? And talk about your company and like where you go and you focus on.
So I was with Eagle Eye for a few years, so sort of once they got sort of set up and everything, and I really had become more of an experienced person. Then through a friend, Doug McRae, he sort of got me in a sense to interview with Field Guides, you know, the big tour company. And then, you know, they hired me, and I was with Field Guides for quite a few years. And I was good. That's where I met George. In fact, George Armistead, I'd actually met him before, but that's where we got to know each other. And you know, we had, in that respect, like working with a big company, I was able to sometimes, you know, they'd say, you want to go tour in Alaska? I'd be like, sure. You know, you want to start a tour in Hawaii? Do you want to create something in, you know, Guatemala? And I started first touring in the trips that they had. Then due to my nature, I started fiddling with tours. From that, I built my own tours, and the company was really happy to get new tours on their schedule. So building a new tour is sort of a fun thing to do, because you sort of can start from scratch and say, you know, if I had 2 weeks, where would I go in this place, you know? And then all of those experiences and, you know, working with the office and all that, I little by little, like, gained all of the elements that I really needed to be doing this on my own. And there was a point where I just said, you know, it's just like, you know, you eventually have to leave home,
yeah,
you know, and forge your own life. I felt like that. It's not a Field Guide. It's always great. I still, you know, they're all great friends. There wasn't sort of any kind of rift or anything that happened. I just felt like I'd become a different person through my experience there, and I needed to do something different by myself. And that's where all those adventures came out. I mean, I guess now it's almost 10 years. It's like actually 9 years or so, you know, it's been really good, really great, because you have control over your schedule, over what you want to do. And I mean, in the last few years, I've been deciding, you know, just like the follow your passion. It's like, I've never been to Bhutan, and somehow Bhutan really, really, you know, ever since I saw a picture of Bhutan, I wanted to go there. So it's like, well, I can, you know, like, let's create a tour with experts from Bhutan, me, you know, and do this. So I've been sort of branching out recently in the last few years, just because, you know, I've always been sort of a Latin America, you know, the Americas, you know, from top to bottom. And going to Asia and going to South Africa and going to Spain. It's sort of one of those things where now I can pick and choose interesting places. Like, India is big on my, I want to go there. So we're putting together an India trip. In the future, I'd love to go to New Zealand, because I love seabirds, you know. So, but, you know, over the years, I've traveled in most of the countries in the Americas. You know, there's very few I haven't been to at this point on tours. And my specialties have always been Chile, you know, and down south, sort of, you know, Uruguay, Argentina. I'm not much in Brazil, but that's going to change too, you know. Colombia, I've had Brazil. A great, yeah, Brazil, it's amazing, the little I've seen, you know. Colombia, I've traveled in quite a bit and been involved with helping Colombia expand their ecotourism birding opportunities through projects, you know, led by this guy, John Myers. And I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he'd be a really fantastic person to also have on here. Talk about how you do birding and conservation and kind of roll all that together, as well as economic development. So yeah, it's been pretty amazing. And one of the things I think is important is that birding is birding, and there's this, the whole love of birds, but that doesn't mean you don't have other interests, right? So I've done trips where it's birds and wine, and we focus a lot on food and wine and birds.
Now the wine, you know, yeah, I was going to ask about that. Now, is that a product of, because Chile's known for wine, or do you have a particular interest in wine? Like, where did that come from?
I'm no wine expert or anything, but I like to eat and I like to have some wine, you know, and stuff. And I thought, well, you know, we would always do these trips to Chile and people go, oh, food's great here and wine's great. And I thought, why don't we focus it a little bit more on that? You know, I mean, I think you learn a lot about places and cultures by their food. And in that specific trip, we go, part of it is in Chile and part of it's in Argentina. So we go to two countries that, although they're side by side, they're actually quite different. And the way they do their food and the way they do their wine is totally different too. So you learn, in a sense, you know, about the two countries through their food, you know, I mean, and I think, and you see the birds, you see the Andes divide up the climates to divide up different ecozones to divide up the way, you know, the type of wine. It's just such a holistic, like, you're like, whoa, you know, and you realize that the whole basis of what makes those two places different is the Andes. Like, the Andes are like a wall, you know. It's like, and culturally, not just biologically. So it's pretty wild. I enjoy that kind of thing. I like the detail, the sort of the subtle detail stuff that happens when you do a tour. And show people things more than just birds. Because for me, travel started so early in my life that, you know, I mean, I'm sure that when you were on tour with the band and stuff, maybe you didn't have enough time all the time. But part of what was fun is like waking up in a new place and you're like, whoa, there's a park out there. Let's see what's going on. And you go, maybe go birding, but you also are watching what people are eating and what's going on. And who's, you know, those little things sometimes. I mean, I just remember like one time I went to Venezuela, like ages ago, when you could go to Venezuela, and, you know, going and getting a little tiny cup of coffee from like this vendor on the street. And there was a lineup of guys and they all had their newspaper, and like they were like big old gas guzzler cars everywhere and, you know, and music blaring, and it was hot and parakeets are flying over. And I still remember that, that just that little like, wow, this is my first tropical Venezuelan coffee I'm ever going to have. This is my first. There might be many more, but this is my first. And just having this little cup of coffee, and it was like this little plastic, crappy little throwaway cup, you know? And I don't know why those little things always kind of stay with me, you know? And so I always think like the birding tour should have those little things in it too. You never know what they're going to be. I can't engineer them.
You know? I agree. And I, you just reminded me of a, this little town in Brazil, kind of in between, the main, you know, Cuiabá, where you go to your jumping off point to the Pantanal, out to like this like this like waterfall in the Cerrado, where you see all the macaws and stuff, and just stopping at this little town and like the plaza there, and this like street barbecue, you know, and like swallowtail kites flying over, and you know, there's a nighthawk perched on the on a branch, and you're just like, this is what it's all about, you know?
Yeah. I think that's what's interesting, and it depends on how you see the world, right? Some people will go and travel and they'll remember that super rare, wow, you know, we saw a blue-throated macaw in Bolivia. But other people will remember some little aspect of, you know, the woman at the lodge making this soup or something. And it was like one of the best soups you've ever had in your life. And you're like wondering how in the middle of nowhere, where they just like have a generator, you know, at night for electricity and that kind of thing, can you make like the best soup in the world? You know, like, it's, you know, so everybody takes away different things from travel. But I feel like if I'm not the person to make a trip that's fully 100% birds, like it has to have other aspects of it for it to be one of my trips, you know? So, but we see a ton of birds, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Just like, it's just like, you know, it's not just about birds.
Well, that sounds ideal to me. And you run a lot of pelagic trips too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So part of what we do in the summer and fall is to do a series of pelagic. So it's been, you know, it's gotten to be about 20 trips a year out of Half Moon Bay, Monterey Bay, Morro Bay, and Bodega Bay, you know, so four different spots in the south, you know. Morro Bay is kind of not quite Southern California, but almost, it's right at the edge, you know, and it's been great. We've seen a lot of neat stuff, shown people a lot of great wildlife, you know, whales, birds, the whole deal. And I truly enjoy pelagic trips. I think they're the excitement of just never knowing what, you know, what you're going to see, and the idea that you put in your time and amazing stuff will happen, you know, and you never know what it is. Sometimes it's like a shark instead of a bird, you know. Bird of the day is a shark, you know.
Yeah, ocean sunfish or something, you know?
Yeah.
I love
that. Yeah, actually, we see those a lot where we are. So
I got to come out and do one with you. I've never done a proper pelagic out of California. I've only done whale watches.
Oh, yeah.
And those are still phenomenal. You know, see black-footed albatross, bullet shearwater, and, you know, a bunch of great birds. But I never and both times I did one, the whales were so close that we never got out even too far. So.
Oh, right. Yeah. That's what happens sometimes, yeah.
That's awesome. How's the future looking for you right now? You don't know.
You know, we don't know. I had to reschedule. I had a Galapagos trip. I should be in Bhutan right now, actually. I had a Galapagos trip that was coming up in the summer. So we had to reschedule both of those for next year. And I did move another trip to the end of this year. So I'm on the optimistic side in some respects, thinking that by the end of the year, even though we probably won't have a vaccine yet and so forth, we'll have procedures. We'll have procedures and also a little bit more comfort with some of the realities. I think one of the fear aspects of COVID that we still are living through is the unknowns, right? And each week we have more knowns. So in a sense, the more we understand, the more you can manage the risk. And, you know, you never want anybody to be in danger. So, and the truth is, like, ironically, you know, without getting too political or whatever, it is safer for a lot of people to be in a different country than it is to be, depending on where you live in the U.S., you know, or Canada, you know, than to be at home, perhaps, you know. So, like, if we, you know, had been, you know, allowed to go to Bhutan, or maybe by next year. I mean, Bhutan's had two cases, and both were from foreigners. Maybe at that time, maybe there's more cases now, but they've locked everything down, and they've, you know, they're really sort of being diligent about not letting this, you know, move through the population. All of Santiago right now is under lockdown, you know, for maybe a couple of weeks to just sort of, in a sense, get the virus down. So many other countries are either have low incidence rates or they're doing something much more drastic than what's happening here. So I have the opposite fear, in a sense, is that when other countries are sort of opening up to tourism, that they might not let us in because we're, you know, we're the ones that are the greater risk. But from the respect of a tourist going to another country, for many other countries, most other countries are actually safer than here. And even my last tour, when I was in Chile and Argentina, people were taking your temperatures there. They were interviewing you. You were talking to a nurse when you got out of the, you know, stuff that was not happening in the U.S. So I feel a certain amount of positivity to that, a lot of places. And maybe one of the things to do is to eventually reassess what the countries are that are safest and begin to go there, you know, and then sort of expand as eventually you get the vaccine and so forth. But on the other hand, what I think, being an optimist too, I think anytime the world goes through a major, major upset and problem, people all reassess what is important to them, what's, you know, what works, what doesn't work. And I think one of the things that'll happen is we will have a lot of things change for the positive long term. There's going to be people, and especially young people who are growing up through this, they're going to say, well, I want to live in that world, you know, I want a better world. And this is where that kind of positive kind of change happens, through some, you know, through some kind of hitting a rock bottom of some type. I think it was easy to just keep on going, doing the same old thing when you could. But once the life says, oh, you can't do the same old thing, then you got to say, okay, well, how do we make it better? You know, that's, I think, there's a punk rock thing.
Yeah, exactly. So many people don't realize punk rock is a positive. It comes from a place of love, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I like that we somehow took a sad subject and turned it to a positive. I think it's a great place to end. How do people find your tour company? Is it just...
It's alvarozadventures.com. So ALVARO, Alvaro's Adventures, all one word. We're, you know, trying to see if we can do the pelagic trips. The earliest we have scheduled right now is July, but we don't have the procedures, right? We don't know from the state, county, what that's going to mean, what it's going to look like. But we're trying to be optimistic and see what we can do. It's possible that our first trips will be pelagic trips with fewer people. And then as you know, things progress, it'll change. But, you know, lots of tours on the books for next year, and going to start doing the 2022 trips, trying to add some new ones in there, perhaps, you know, to go to Guyana.
Yeah. I really want you to see that, you know, see a Rufus Neck Hornbill for me.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And they got red pandas there too, right?
Yeah, I've seen the tree where like this great photo of a red panda is, you know, was taken. I've seen the tree.
Oh, so you've been there?
The red panda.
I've actually been. Okay, but you're going to go again. Awesome.
Yeah. So, you know, I look forward to it. I really enjoyed Bhutan. So, yeah.
Fantastic. I mean, any country where archery is a national sport seems like a place I need to visit.
Well, you should see them though. They're amazing. We you know, because you'll see it roadside. Like there'll be a archery competition, and you just sort of stop. It's a really like relaxed place. You stop and you watch. You can't even see the target with your eyes. Like I had to use binoculars.
Wow. They're
like, whoa! And these guys are getting it. You know, getting their arrows within inches of the. Like, how do you do that? You know, like I don't know.
That's unbelievable.
I know.
Yeah, check that out. Well, hey, buddy, it's great talking to you. Yeah. So everybody, please like and subscribe to Wildlife Observer Network and review us on your podcasting platform of choice. Avro, thank you so much. And
hey, no problem.
I'm going to say goodbye to the podcasters now, and then I'll talk to you for a split second afterwards.